Hello, welcome to Tea or Books. I'm Simon.
I'm Rachel.
This is episode 150, and as long-term listeners might know, every 50 episodes we do a Q&A, and thank you so much for all your questions. We got loads, and they're really, really good ones. So can't wait to get into those. We'll just really quickly, though, first talk about what we're reading, what we're up to. How are you doing, Rachel?
I'm good, thank you. I've been jet-setting around Central Europe the last couple of weeks on successive school trips, so I'm just enjoying having a little bit of downtime. And also my eldest students are now on study leave, so this is the time in the school year where things start to chill out a little bit and I can actually contemplate reading a book, which is nice. So I'm currently reading Careless People by Sarah Wynne Williams, which is all about her time working at Facebook, which I'm finding very interesting, actually. I always find it interesting reading about people with jobs that are very far removed from what I do.
Yeah, I listened to the audiobook last year, and it was infuriating and interesting, and she did sort of make it out like she was the one true voice of virtue there, but which I suspect was not true, but fascinating.
I would find it interesting to hear the other side of the story for sure, but I think it's very interesting from lots of perspectives, and also the psychological perspective of how you can get kind of sucked into a workplace and let it become your whole life. So I highly recommend it. It's very readable, even for people who don't normally kind of delve into that kind of thing. And it's less of, it's obviously a memoir, but it's also an interesting insight into the tech industry, I think. So it's, if you're interested in that, it's well worth reading. And I'm still reading Honourable Estate by Vera Brittain. I've broken the 600 page mark, so I've only got about 50 pages left. I will make it to the end. It has felt like a slog, but not a non-enjoyable one. It's just one of those books where you're like, this could have been half the length and still told me everything it needed to tell me.
Do you remember 3 episodes ago when you suggested we do it for the next episode? We would never have got to episode 150.
It'd just been like going on forever. But if you know, if you've got, it's, do you know what it is? It's a winter read. I should have read it earlier in the day. You're sort of curled up in the evening and you've got loads of time on your hands to read. It's not a book really for this time of year when you want to be out and about a bit more.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah. And what about you? What have you been up to? What are you reading?
Well, it's the 5th or 6th year in a row, I think, where I've done a book a day in May. So reading a book a day. So far, I'm on track, and we're recording. It's the 19th. I think I've read lots of very good ones, but the one I read yesterday I really loved, which was Catching Fire by Daniel Hahn, which is nonfiction. It's subtitled A Translation Diary, and it's basically, I think it was originally a blog, which he then published, of his experience of translating Daimela Eltet's Chilean novel, which I'm not going to attempt to pronounce in Spanish, but was translated as Never Did the Fire. And he goes through from his rough draft through to all the like fiddly little translation decisions. And I didn't speak any Spanish, but it was still so interesting. And I already had huge amounts of respect for translators, but it have even more. So now it was, yeah, really, really, I think one of my favorite little moments in it was a scene where someone complains about their wrist being painful. And someone else repeats this a lot, and it quickly becomes clear in the Spanish that it plays on the fact that there is the same word for wrist and for doll. And he was like, how on earth do I convey that in English? I don't know what the solution was. I don't think he tells us. But yeah, absolutely fascinating to anyone who's got any interest in literary translation.
Well, that sounds really interesting. I'll have to get hold of that.
Yeah, I bought it 3 years ago on a sort of, I must read this immediately. And here we are. I finally read it.
Well, everything's got a time and a place.
Exactly.
I do believe that.
Right, so let's get into these questions. So as usual, we're going to take it in turns to ask the question, but we'll both answer them unless they're very clearly directed to one of us. So I'm going to start off with a question. I've put these in random order, by the way, so don't read anything into the order. But Michaela asks, do you have recommendations for interwar novels featuring adultery similar to Appendice the Peep Show, which we did an episode on ages ago?
Are you answering that, or
oh, sorry, you answer first, and then I'll chime in. Yeah, okay, once you've okay.
Well, I was thinking this. This is not written during the interval period, but it is set partially during the interval period, and it's The Echoing Grove by Rosamund Naiman, which I read years ago and haven't ever actually reread, and I would like to. But it's a very heady portrayal of a love affair. It's a love triangle, really. It's there's a married couple, and the man is having an affair with his wife's sister, and it kind of drags on through. It starts before World War II and then goes on throughout the war, and is really enjoyable, I think, and powerful in its exploration of emotions, and the setting against the war is. And Rosamund Naiman obviously lived through it as well, so it feels, even though I think it's written in the early 1950s, it still feels very kind of current and fresh and very vivid, the description of the war. And it was made into quite a bad made for TV movie with Helena Bonham Carter in it, of all people.
You're gracious.
Yeah. And it's not The Echoing Grove, the film. It's called The Heart of Me, which I think is maybe the American title of the book.
Heart of Me, gosh, what a much worse title. The one I was going to suggest, published in 1925, is William by E.H. Young, which is basically what happens in this family, of which William is the patriarch, when one of his daughters runs off with I think he's a married man, or maybe it's just outside of marriage. It might not be adultery. Double check that. But yeah, I thought it was absolutely fascinating, because he's very, like, he responds in an unexpected way, and the novel is very nuanced. Yeah.
Wow. I think I've read that, actually.
Yeah, I've not read it for years. That's clear from me not remembering all the details, but it's very, very good.
Yeah. And there's also The End of the Affair by Graham Greene, which is very famous, but that's...
oh, yes, of course. Good point.
Very enjoyable as well. Okay, so the next question for me, from Anne. Thanks, Anne. How do you both avoid buying books you already own while out book shopping?
Well, I have an app from Library Thing that has saved me so much money over time. I catalogued all my books on there. So I've got about 3,500 books, and I'm forever like Googling on my, or looking up in my Library Thing app. Do I already own this? And I always want to like hold it aloft, being like, I'm not looking on Amazon. I'm not one of those people who goes to a bookshop and sees if I can buy it cheaper somewhere else. I'm checking if I already own it. And there must be dozens, maybe hundreds of books that I've left on shelves because of it.
That's very impressive. I mean, obviously, I'm a very disorganized person, so I don't have the same technological backup for my collection. But I am blessed with an incredibly good memory, which people listening to this would be like, really? Because you can never remember the names of characters or things. Weirdly enough, not for stuff that I've done recently, but like long term stuff, I have a really good memory for. So I know each and every one of my books that I have. So if I'm out book shopping, I will know instantly whether I've got it or not. Same with my play collection. For some reason, I just know. I've never bought something twice.
That's very impressive. Sai says, do you like baking? What do you like to bake?
I do like baking, but I don't bake very often, actually, largely because number one, I can't be bothered. Number two, it just takes a lot of time. And I also live by myself, so if I make a cake, I will eat it all, and that's not a good thing. But my favourite thing to bake is I really enjoy. There is a recipe in a book by Honey and Co. So Honey and Co. is like a London actually only chain of restaurants that does Middle Eastern food. And it's a delicious pistachio and cherry cake, which is like one of those cakes that's made with very little flour. So it's kind of quite nut based, and it's absolutely delicious. And so when I feel like I've got people coming over and I need to make something that's like a little bit impressive, that's what I make.
That sounds amazing. I used to love baking more than I do, perhaps, more when I lived in house shares for similar reasons. But I usually just make Victoria's sponges, to be honest. But one thing I discovered that I do love is I went to a Eurovision party a few years ago where we had to bring something from a country we were given, and I was given Ukraine. And I was looking up all these different things. I was like, I don't really want to make like a hearty stew or something for a party. But I discovered they have a Kiev cake, which is hazelnut meringue with chocolate ganache inside a sponge cake. So it's enormous.
Delicious.
It's so nice. And quite often now I just make the meringue and the ganache part. And it's one of these ones where you put the meringue in the oven at the like 50 or 60 or something, very low temperature for like 8 hours. So it's just very low and slow, but it is so tasty and gluten-free if you just do the meringue. So that's useful.
A Kiev cake.
Kiev cake.
Well, I've got a student who lived in Kiev for a long time, so I'm going to ask her about this tomorrow.
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, I can see pictures. Oh my gosh, it's enormous. All those layers.
Yeah, it's huge. It is huge. And it's meant to be a flourless sponge. I did not do that. I just made a regular sponge when I did it.
Gosh, delicious. Okay. Well, when I go to Ukraine eventually, hopefully I will have some. Okay, so this next question is from Amber, who is Simon's favourite cousin. How many cousins do you have and who's going to be offended?
She did declare herself my favourite cousin, I should say. But you know what, Amber? I think you are my favourite cousin. So congrats. And I've got 7, so sucks to be all the rest of them.
Okay, wow. You've only got 7 cousins. I've got about 40.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, both my parents have got lots of siblings. So are you for or against people underlining passages and or writing in books?
I am fine with it in pencil. I'm very anti it in pen.
Yeah, I think I would have the same stance there, actually. If it's removable, it's okay. If it's not, you're basically a terrorist.
It does physically pain me to see people write in pens. But thank you, Amber, and we should see each other more often. You're great. Christopher asks, Rachel, what do you think is the best portrayal of the teaching experience that you've read?
That's a very good question. Now I'm gonna go, there are lots of books that I've read that have been great depictions, I think, of university teaching, but because that's not what I do, I would say for me, it's actually Fresh from the Country by Miss Reed, which is a primary school teacher. So it's, I mean, I teach secondary, don't ever put me in a primary school classroom, but it's so brilliant, that book. It's one of her standalone novels. For those of you who aren't familiar with Miss Reed, she's most famous for her 2 kind of long series of books, the Thrush Green books and the Fairacre books. But she was a teacher herself before she started writing. So it's written with complete knowledge of what it's like to manage a classroom, to absolutely adore your students, but also want to kill them at the same time. the exhaustion of teaching, the creativity of it, the fact that you never switch off from it, that you're always thinking about, oh, that would make a good lesson, or I must get that for this child or whatever. And yeah, it was just, I read it, even though it was written in the 1950s, when I read it, I just thought, I totally recognise everything about this depiction of being in the classroom. Though she does have 50 children in a class in the book, so I'm very glad to say that we have improved things from that perspective now. But,
and yeah, we did an episode on it a while back, so people can go and
really,
we might have to be speedy in our answers. I'm afraid we've got so many questions.
Sorry.
That's all right. I'm not going to answer that one because I'm not a teacher, so you go on to the next one.
Okay, so Sally says, who are your go-to contemporary writers?
Well, we're so lucky, actually, that 2 of my not that many go-to contemporary writers are people we've had on the podcast. So Mary Lawson and Edward Carey are 2 of the people who, if they publish a book, I'll go and get it. And there's not really, I can't think of that many others who are, I mean, Solfer Bella now, I guess, that I'm reading this long series by her, but there's not many. I read quite a lot of contemporary writers, but there aren't that many who I'm like, if their book's coming out, I'm getting it. Oh, Marilyn Robinson is the other one.
Yeah, I think I for me, like, if I'm gonna, I never buy hardbacks. So the only person that I will go out on publishing day and go and buy a hardback is Elizabeth Strout, who I absolutely love, and her new book came out like 2 weeks ago, and I've got it sitting here waiting. I'm very excited. She never goes wrong.
She never goes wrong. Rachel, congrats on the stage play. That says Maria. And yes, we have not talked about Night Shift. It was so good. Rachel's brilliant. I loved it. And it was a relief, because if it had been bad, it would have been very embarrassing.
It was terrible. It was.
Maria adds, what kind of plays do you want to write? What is your niche? Why the Superstore employees drama specifically?
Gosh, lots of questions. So I think I write very hyper-realist stuff. So that's like, you know, as if the people are real, and I write the dialogue. So it's very realistic, like you're sort of overhearing people speaking. And I really like writing about sort of everyday situations, things that happen in workplaces, recognisable situations. I'm also really interested in exploring kind of lesser explored perspectives. So I like writing about people, working class people, people with jobs that get overlooked, that sort of thing. So that's why I wrote a book about people working in a supermarket, because I've also worked in a supermarket and I've worked on the night shift. So everything I write is kind of informed by things that I've experienced directly as well, which I think is quite important if you want it to feel real.
Nice. And quite a few people mentioned congratulations about the play when they wrote in, but I let Maria stand in for them all.
So Sydney says, what book challenged one of your strongly held beliefs?
I've got a funny, sort of flippant answer and a more serious answer for this. So my flippant one is, I can't remember what this specifically is called, but the middle of Paul Auster's New York trilogy is the only book I've ever read that is very good despite not having speech marks. So that challenged my strongly held belief that all books should have speech marks. My slightly less flippant answer, and I don't actually remember the authors, I read a very good book called Misreading Scripture with Western Eyes, which basically looks at the Bible and the things about the culture of those who are writing it that are different from, he says Western, he largely means American, but I could sort of interpret. And it really helped me like read in a less individualistic way and understand concepts of time and structure more in the Bible. And so I don't know if it challenged the belief, but it certainly challenged the way I read the Bible, and I really recommend interpreting scripture with Western eyes.
Interesting.
Misinterpreting scripture with Western eyes. Importantly, carry on.
I think I thought for a very long time that magical realism wasn't for me. And then I read, what's the book called? Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
100 Years of Solitude?
100 Years of Solitude, that's it. And it just blew me away. And I thought, well, I can't believe I've spent over 30 years avoiding all of magical realism when I could have been enjoying myself reading this brilliant stuff. So that for me has challenged my reading beliefs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh no, this is your question, isn't it? Your belief.
Oh gosh, have we gone? Oh yeah, I don't know what's happened. I think I just asked two questions in a row. Oh no, you did answer that. Okay, we're fine. Andrea says, what is the most disappointing book you've ever read?
You go first. I need to think about that.
Yeah, it's tricky, because I think disappointment is when you expect it to be really good. So it's not by any means the worst book I've ever read. But I remember I got a copy of Sun City by Tove Jansson that has, I think, now been reprinted by the New York Review of Books, but for a long time was quite relatively hard to get hold of. And I saved it for years, thinking this is the last Tove Jansson novel that has been translated that I've not read. I love her so much. And then I read it and was like, oh, it is comfortably her worst book, and that was a shame, because I'd like really built it out to be like, I've got this gem, I'm going to discover this brilliant new book by one of my favorite authors, and it was fine, but it was disappointing.
I think the most disappointing book I've ever read was The Luminaries by Eleanor Catton, which won the Booker Prize about over 10 years ago now. And it was so long, and it took me such a long time to read it. And it was kind of like an interesting concept. So I was like, do you know what? I'm committed. I'll read on to the end. Took me ages. I got to the end and I was like, that was it. I was just really so annoyed and disappointed that I committed so much time to something that just ended with a sort of damp squib. and never delivered the promise that it gave. So yeah, that was not great for me.
Well, same.
Sorry. Rebecca says, are there any books which make you cry?
Now, interestingly, like, I will cry at almost any film. Like, I cry at songs on the radio. I cry a lot, but not that often while I'm reading. And the book that I've cried most at was Simon Stevenson's Let Not the Ways of the Sea, which is nonfiction about his brother who died in the New Year tsunami back in 2004-05. And it then becomes sort of a travelogue of him going to that place to help rebuild. And it's also quite philosophical. It's also a memoir of their brotherly relationship. And I think just because my brother is so important to me, and he describes the brotherly relationship so well, I cried basically every time I picked it up, including in public.
Wow. I have to try that. I cry at books all the time, so this would be a very long list. I'm a terrible sobber. My students all laugh at me because I'm always like got teary eyes when I'm reading this. The book that makes me cry the most, though, and that I do have to sort of lie down afterwards when I read it, is The Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro, because it just breaks my heart every time. Absolutely breaks my heart.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
This next question is from my brother. He says, if you're in a hot air balloon with Charles Dickens and the complete works of Charles Dickens and had to throw one of them over the side, which would you pick? It's asking the important questions.
I would save the person and get rid of the books.
Yeah, I think that's probably always the right answer, isn't it? Yeah.
Anonymous. Can Simon speak about the current status of the British Library Women's Writers series? Are you still involved, and to what extent? Are there any more forthcoming novels? And if so, can you share or hint what they might be? What titles have they rejected? That's quite a lot of questions.
It is, and I'm just going to, you know, going to put it all out there. I am still involved, and I have stepped back from involvement with the short story collections. That was my choice, because it took a lot of time and I just wasn't as interested in them as I am in the novels. And I think they just needed someone more interested and invested in them to do them. And that certainly was my choice. And they were slightly reluctant for me to do it, but they've got someone great doing those introductions. I'm still a bit involved in the selections. The sad truth for me is that the short story collections do sell better than the novels, because I guess they're easier to give as gifts or something, you know, Christmas short stories. And that's sad to me because the novels are where my heart really is. But there will be another one coming soon. The Spring House by Cynthia Asquith is coming out soon, which is a brilliant book. And I'm really pleased they're doing that. It's one of my favourite books last year or the year before, sometime, whenever I read it. I don't yet know of any others that are coming, but there, as far as I know, there will be more, but they're just doing fewer. So if you want there to be more, please encourage people to buy them. If you get a bestseller, there'll definitely be more. In terms of what they rejected, they've rejected quite a few because they were just not, you know, didn't quite fit the criteria. I think the only one I've suggested and that I love that they decided not to just because they didn't think it was good enough was Economy Must Be Our Watchword by Joyce Dennis, which I'm sad about because I love that book.
Interesting.
Which almost got republished by Dean Street Press as well, but then sadly it was just before Rupert died. So it's a book that keeps almost coming back into print, but not quite.
Well, maybe you need to get it back into print, Simon. You need to start your own press.
Just for that. I think I've run out of most of my ideas. I've given them all to the British Library. Rhoda says, do you like reading books by Ian McEwan? I remember the one time McEwan was mentioned, UT seemed underwhelmed and moved on very quickly from talking about his books. I thought it's pretty funny and it's put him on a lower pedestal for me.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not the biggest fan of Ian McEwan. I think that Atonement is quite a good book, though I did lose a bit of respect for it after teaching it. Once you pull it apart a bit more, I was like, there's a lot in here that my students were like, is this intentional, like picking up on things? I was like, I'm not sure that that was actually. So yeah, I mean, I think it, Enduring Love and Atonement are quite good, but he's not a favourite writer of mine and he's not one I would rush to pick up. But I do understand why some people like him.
Yeah, I love some books by him. I think Black Dogs is brilliant. I like Atonement a lot. I like Enduring Love. I like Amsterdam is very, very good. I really hated the Cement Garden. It was just like needlessly vile. Yeah. And I think the most recent one I've read might be on Chesil Beach. I don't think I've read anything since then. I think he just keeps doing things. I'm like, really, did we have to have Hamlet from the perspective of a fetus? Is that something that people want? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I don't know. I also just find, when he talks about books, I like them less than when I've read them independently of him talking about them. I didn't like Saturday particularly, and that didn't help either. But some I love. Early McEwen, except for in his like really gory, unpleasant, gratuitously phase.
I don't think he's produced anything that particularly interesting to me for about 15 years. Michaela says, I just read Fenny by Lettys Cooper on holiday in Malta after hearing about it in one of your episodes. I loved it. I'm so glad. I know she was a prolific writer, and I was wondering if either of you had read any other books by her and whether you found them to be similar to Fenny. Are there any that are particular favourites?
I've read a few books by her. I guess the one that a lot of people have read is The New House that Seffi did, which is really good. I think we did an episode on that at some point.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. I read Desirable Residence, which was written in 1980, and it's about like thugs taking over a house, and it's very... It feels very like modern for 1980 in a way that was actually really convincing for an author who had been writing for decades and decades at that point. And then I read Black Bethlehem, that was dreadful. And I think I read another, like, she's very variable. I think Fenny and The New House are the best ones I've read. And I think I gave up on another one. So yeah, she wrote a lot, and some of them aren't very good, but some of them are.
Yes, I really love The New House. I feel like I've read another one of her novels as well. And it was kind of long and a little bit Winifred Holtby-esque. And I enjoyed it very much, but I can't remember.
I was going to say, from you, that's a positive. From me, it's not.
I couldn't tell you what it's called. But it's good. But I think for me, Fenny is the best I've read. So good.
Christopher says, the podcast has been going a long time now. So indeed it has. What has been the biggest shift in your literary tastes since it kicked off?
I think I've become more of a reader of contemporary fiction, and I've also, I'm more intentional about making sure I read outside of my comfort zone, and I try to pick up works in translation, and writers from different cultures to mine, much more than I used to.
Yeah, it's a good question, Christopher. It's not really a taste thing, but my biggest shift in reading in general has been audiobooks. Like, I didn't ever listen to audiobooks when they started, and now, like last year, I listened to like 92 audiobooks or something. So a lot more audiobooks, which in turn means I listen to a lot more nonfiction, because I do like nonfiction audiobooks, and from on topics that I might not have tried as a print book. So yeah, things like Careless People mentioned earlier, or a lot of like psychology books, or things that would put me off in print, I will give a go for audio. So it's helped that way.
Right. I mean, that's impressive. I can't listen to audiobooks, as we know. So I'm very in awe of your ability. Bramble has asked, where do you read? Do you use pillows on your lap to bolster the books?
Yeah, great question. I guess I read everywhere. I don't read much in bed. Well, I never really read in bed in the evening. I like reading in bed in the morning, and then I will use pillows and a sort of arrangement of duvets to bolster the books. And I'm also, if I'm reading on the sofa or on my bed, I'm usually trying to angle myself around a cat as well. So it's quite hard to find a place to put a book that doesn't have him in the way. Otherwise, you know, I read at work, I might lunch hour, I read on public transport. I sometimes read walking down the street. So I read pretty much anywhere.
I do most of my reading on public transport. I do read a little bit before I go to bed. I never use pillows to bolster the books. I don't need to. I can't imagine why I would need to unless I had a really heavy book. I don't ever tend to, I don't read much. I don't sort of lie on the sofa and read. I don't tend to do that anyway. But yeah, it's kind of a bed thing or a train thing for me, or bus or whatever, yeah.
Rebecca and Bronwyn did not ask this question together, but they both asked favourite literary adaptations. And Rebecca particularly wants to know your take on Clueless, since, of course, it's based on Emma.
Well, I'm very happy to oblige. I very much enjoy Clueless. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And, you know, the fashion, the cleverness of the take on it, the way in which it provided a Jane Austen resurgence for a new generation. I mean, what's not to love? Other than that, I think favourite literary adaptations for me, I mean, staying on the Emma theme, I really like the Romola Gary TV series version of Emma. I think that's my favourite of all the Jane Austen adaptations. I don't love the Colin Firth version of Pride and Prejudice. I don't mind it. No, I don't mind it. And it's of all the adaptations there have been, it is the best one for sure. But I do just think it's a little bit dated these days. And everyone's a little bit too old. Do you know what I mean?
That is a scandalous episode 150 revelation.
I know.
But there is another version coming this year, so maybe that'll be your new favourite.
I've heard, but I'm not convinced from what I've seen so far, but we'll see.
No.
What about you?
Well, my favourite film is The Hours, which is an adaptation of Michael Cunningham's novel. So that's my favourite adaptation as well, I guess. But in terms of TV, I love the BBC Pride and Prejudice with Colin Firth and Jennifer Ely, and have a soft spot in my heart for the BBC Chronicles of Narnia from the late 80s, early 90s.
Oh, yes, I enjoyed that.
Yeah, and I love Clueless as well. I think it's one of the cleverest Austen adaptations out there.
Yeah. Is this me or are you the next one?
Oh, you named it. Yep, Erin.
If you could be any character in a novel, who would you be? And which one do you most like?
I was thinking about this. I think I would most like to be Winnie the Pooh. He seems to have a nice life. He's got a great bunch of friends. He has a lovely time. He has some adventures, but they always end up well. So, Winnie the Pooh. And who do I most like? I was trying to think... probably Joe Gargery from Great Expectations. Such a lovely man.
Him. He is such a lovely, kind man.
Yeah.
But, you know, life doesn't go well for him.
That's why he's the one I like most, not the one I'd like to be.
Yeah, fair enough. Good distinction there. The character I would most like to be is probably Emma. I mean, who wouldn't want to be Emma, right? In many ways, I feel like I am Emma, which is why I connect with her so deeply. Character I most like. That's an interesting one. Do you know what? I think I most like and want to give a cuddle to, again, in Emma, Miss Bates. She's so sweet and kind and lovely, and Emma's so mean to her, but she's, you know, she never says a bad word about anyone else, and I think that is the kind of person you want to be.
Yeah, I don't know if I've just bought into Emma's propaganda that she'd be annoying to be around. Maybe she actually wouldn't. Maybe she'd be nice.
But, I think she'd be great. She'd be a really good laugh.
Yeah, well, there you go. Sidonie asks, which book do you find yourself recommending over and over, and why?
Oh, I'm obsessed with Claire Keegan, and I recommend Small Things Like These and Foster to everyone. And I've never had somebody be disappointed by the recommendation. It's one of those books you're like, no matter what kind of person you are or what you're into, you're going to enjoy it.
For some reason, it's been years now. If anyone asks me to recommend a book, my mind goes completely blank except for Boy Snowbird by Helen Oyeyemi, which, and that's so often the one I recommend, even though it's like, it's not a favourite book of mine. I just remember really liking it. And it's the only book I ever think of. Generally, if someone asks for a recommendation, I say like, what other books do you like? Can you give me a bit of, but yeah, I keep recommending Boy Snowbird by Helen Oyeyemi. So there you
go. Why not? Maria says, Simon, getting a second cat. Thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely not, Maria. Hargreaves hates cats, so he wouldn't cope with another one. And the genuine reason that I didn't get more than one cat when I first adopted him was that I thought they might freeze me out, so I needed to keep him needy. So I'm not proud of it. Patricia says, would love to hear Oh, we have got another play question. We'll love to hear from both of your reactions to Rachel's Night Shift play and why she decided to start her own theatre company.
Well, I mean, I thought it went well. I was very pleased with it. I didn't direct it, so it was, you know, there were some things that I weren't in the script that I wouldn't have come up with myself. But that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. I think it's good to have someone else's take on it. Why did I decide to start up my own theatre company? Well, it's a way to get your work on in London, certainly. It's a very competitive environment out here, and otherwise you just have to hope that somebody, you meet the right person or your work wins competition or something. So if you want to do something, you have to do it yourself. And it gives me creative agency over what I do, and it's just fun to have something else to be like working on and to make connections with people. And yeah, so that's why.
Nice. Was the dancing in the script, or was that the director?
That was the director.
I did think it probably wasn't you. Not that I didn't enjoy it. Well, I've already said I loved it. It was very funny. It was very moving. I was just bowled over by the talent of my friend. Because I thought, you know, sometimes if you hear like a poem by a friend or something by a friend, you're in your head just being like, I know who wrote this, and it sort of takes away. Whereas this, I could just, it was like I was seeing any other professional playwright and I could enjoy it on its own merits, which were many. So well done,
Simon. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Hopefully it will be touring the UK at some point, so more people might.
Ooh, that's exciting. We'll definitely keep people up to date if it is.
Keep you up to date, yeah.
Oh, and it was so lovely to meet Jerry, who gave us both books at Night Shift. So thanks so much, Jerry.
Thank you so much. It was so kind. I'm sorry I didn't get to see you. I was surrounded by people. Right, Charles asks, why, despite the level of violence in our society and in the world generally, does crime fiction prosper? Very good question. Would it be simply entertainment, or will some novels become classics?
Yeah, I mean, I don't read crime because I'm so squeamish. Mm-hmm. And it does feel, there was that prize a while ago, wasn't there, for books?
Yes.
That didn't, in which women weren't like mutilated, and there was this big uprising of how dare you not let us write about women being butchered, because it happens in the real world, as though every book had to have everything that happened in the real world in it. Mm. I'm uncomfortable with the amount of violence in books, and if it's there for entertainment purposes, because why is that entertaining to you? It upsets me that people will read these things and just sort of glide up, particularly true crime. I think that's horrible. Like, why are we being entertained by these things? So in terms of classics, like, there have been some, obviously In Cold Blood is a true crime classic. There are many crime books that are classics. I guess I just don't know enough of the ones currently being published to be able to answer that. But someone like Val McDermott, I get the impression, is well respected as a writer as well as a crime writer, so I'm sure some of hers might well become classics.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like Gothic literature, isn't it? It's, you know, we deal with the things that frighten us by putting them into fiction. And I think that's why it's such a popular genre, because it's scary, but it's safe at the same time, because it's not real. And it's, you know, people enjoy watching police shows, don't they? And a lot of the crime fiction now is very much built around police procedural work. I think people find that really fascinating. It's not my genre at all, but I mean, for me, I think the classics of crime fiction are those sort of golden age novels, and like Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers. And what's interesting is that the violence in them is very sanitized. You don't really see anything. So I wonder whether there's something there about the kind of a difference in taste and quality. I can't imagine much of the crime fiction that's for sale in my local Tesco's will become a classic in the future.
I've accidentally included a question we've had from someone else, really, but Sally says, in what ways have your reading interests changed since you started the podcast? Do you have a different answer now to when we answered to Christopher? Sorry, right. Sally, that was clumsy of me. Well, I'll do a different one, because I did like format before. But a big interest I have now, ever since I think it was Department of Speculation by Jenny Offill that started it, is I love books told in vignettes, like Blue Postcards by Douglas Bruton that we did recently. And I will pick up anything that does that. And I've read, what was it called, In the Dream House by whoever wrote that? Carmen, I forget her name, in the Dreamhouse nonfiction. There was one Paul Bailey did called Trespassers, I think. And there's so many out there, and I've almost invariably really enjoyed them. It's a form that I really love.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah.
I think it's always good to have a change to what you read, isn't it? Right. Michaela says, one of the best books I read last year was The Long View by Elizabeth Jane Howard. I know you've mentioned her a few times on the podcast, but I was wondering if you had any favourites by her.
It's one of those names we used to mention all the time. I have still only read the first of the Catholic Chronicles, so that, I guess that's my favourite by her. But have you read more widely?
Yes, I have. I've read a lot of her books, actually. I mean, the Catholic Chronicles are absolutely brilliant works of genius, and I think are her kind of magnum opus. You really should read more than the first one, Simon.
I've also just remembered we actually did one of her books, so I have read The Something Visit. What was that?
Oh, The Beauty Visit.
The Beauty Visit, which I didn't like very much.
Yeah, it's not her best, to be honest. It is her first book. I think The Sea Change is also very good, well worth reading. But The Long View, I think, is also excellent. But yeah, I do think The Catholic Chronicles are like the best books ever. They're such, you know, so absorbing.
And I do have them all borrowed from my mum for about 6 years, probably maybe 10 years. Speaking of which, mum has asked the next question. You have the complete works of a favourite author, but you must give one of the books away. Which author and which book?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Can I do two?
Sure, yeah.
So, Jane Austen. I would give away Mansfield Park.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, I see the brilliance of it, but I don't care about any of the characters. And the other one, Dorothy Whipple, I would give away Young Anne.
Ah, the only one I've not read by her.
You're not missing out.
I will pick Virginia Woolf, and I will give away Roger Fry, biography, which really sort of
out. No, you have to choose a fiction.
Oh, okay, in which case I'll get rid of Flush.
That's not really fiction either.
Oh my gosh, yeah. At this point there'll be nothing left. Okay, well, in which the case I'm gonna get, but I've not read Night and Day, so I don't know if I want to get rid of that or not. I think I'm gonna get rid of Orlando, controversially, because every time I read it I like it slightly less, so I think I need to stop reading it. So yeah. Orlando's gone.
Okay, fine, I accept that as well.
Oh dear. But yes, otherwise Austin and Mansfield Park is a very good answer. Yeah.
Oh, poor old Fanny Price. Rebecca says, do you listen to any other literary podcasts, and if so, are there any you'd particularly recommend? Now I know you'll have lots of answers for this.
Yeah, I mean, my favourite ones don't exist anymore, sadly. So Reading the End and The Readers were my favourite, but they've gone. But I do listen to quite a few. There's not that many that I listen to every episode of, but I will pick bits and pieces from the Mooks and the Gripes podcast is really good. One Bright Book is great. The Book Club Review podcast. Unburied Books, I haven't seen around recently, but they're great. I've been a guest on most of these podcasts, I now realise, but which isn't the only reason I like them. They're all people I knew from like Instagram or other book blogs. And you really can't do better. This is one I always do listen to for a good read on Radio 4, which they do as a separate podcast. That's, yeah, absolutely wonderful. Last time we did a Q&A, I don't think you listened to any other literary podcasts. Is that still true?
Yeah, I don't really do podcasts. Including my own.
It's very good that you're here, yeah. Considering.
I just cannot.
Griera is actually quite a long email of suggestions, which I've summarised here as, would you consider including more Australian authors in your discussions? And she gave a long list of suggestions, and I've included some here. Elizabeth Jolly, Helen Garner, Shirley Hazzard, and Madeline St. John, I guess, or St. John, I don't know.
Yes, absolutely. It's just our lovely Greer that we know and love.
It is, who is not Australian, but obviously likes Australian writers.
Lovely Greer. Hi, Greer. Greer is so well read. So I think, yes, in answer to that question, I would like to include more Australian authors, because actually, of all the kind of English speaking countries where writers are writing in English as a first language, I would say probably it's the place I've explored the least, really, in terms of literature. So I'm always open to recommendations and reading more.
Yeah, and of course I'm open. I love Helen Garner's nonfiction. I've read almost all her nonfiction, but only a couple of her fiction. I've read one Elizabeth Jolly. I would love to read Shelley Hazard. She's on my list. In fact, I bought one the other day, but she feels like a big gap in my reading education, and I'm not particularly widely read in Australian literature either, but she's one who, I don't think she's even like a regional writer now. She's just like international renown. So I should read her. Have you read Shelley Hazard?
No, I haven't.
Maybe one for a future episode.
Well, there we are. We need to step up. Okay. Maria asks, Simon, how do you think on the calculation of volume septology will end? Do you reckon she gets out of the time loop or...
Yeah, good question, Maria. So I've read three of them now. There's four published in English. I think yes. I think it will end with either like the first morning of November 19th or somehow us knowing it's the last November 18th. That's my prediction.
I'm really looking forward to reading them, actually.
Oh, you will love them, I feel sure. Yeah. I think the fifth one's coming out later this year in English. And the seventh one might be coming out in Danish, I guess. Emily says, what's your best and worst travel experience? What's your bucket list destination?
Oh. I was talking about this to someone the other day. My favourite holiday of all time remains my trip to Jordan and to go to Petra, which was the most incredible thing I've ever seen in my life. My worst travel experience, not because of the country, I really loved Costa Rica, but what I didn't love was the little friend who decided to lodge itself in my bowel while I was there. Which made traveling around slightly uncomfortable experience, lots of driving on long drives while your stomach isn't feeling great was not that enjoyable. So that would be my worst travel experience. My bucket list destination, I would very much like to go to Japan, so that's going to be like my next holiday that I'm saving up for at the moment.
I think my best, just because it was so moving, was going to Bethlehem and that and environs, just being where Jesus was absolutely amazing. I don't think I've had a really dreadful travel experience, thankfully. There was one family holiday where we did all fall out with each other, but you know, we were teenagers.
That happening, Simon?
It was a tough time, but I still look back fondly on that trip, so it can't have been that bad. I guess this was actually a lovely trip in the end, but the first time I went to America, I went to visit my friend in DC, and there was a federal shutdown, so everything was closed, and that was a bit of a shame to be like, oh, I've come all this way. And my bucket list, I would love to go to the island where Tove Jansson lived, and I've never been to Scandinavia in general, and I'd love to go to Finland, but specifically I'd love to go to where she wrote her books.
Wonderful. Well, you should make a plan, make it happen.
Yeah.
Susan asks, which three writers would you invite to a dinner party?
Oh, I've not thought about this. I'm going to say things off the top of my head. Well, E.M. Delafield, I think, is just so...
So I was just going to say they can be alive or dead, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Well, hopefully they'll be alive when they're at the dinner party. Just a pile of ashes around the room. E.M. Delafield, Agatha Christie always seemed like a good time. And who will my third be? I'm going to go for... You're a writer. You're coming to my dinner party.
Oh, my goodness, Simon. Oh, I'd love that. Right. Well, obviously, Jane Austen's coming to mind.
Nice.
Goes without saying, because I want to chat to her all about Emma. I would also invite Elizabeth Strout, because I think she's amazing. And who else would I invite? Daphne du Maurier. I reckon she would be great at a dinner party.
I think she'd be nice at the party. I think she'd write you scathing letters afterwards. Funny. Mary says, I absolutely love collecting collections of books. Persephone, British Library Women Writers, Virago, DNC Press, Pensler, American Mystery Classics, and some Fritz Gerardo. Have either of you been drawn to similar collections?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I love Persephone books, and I also love Fritz Gerardo books. I mean, I don't necessarily collect books, but for me, it's like, it's a marker of quality. And I think, oh, well, I know that I've liked lots of their books. So if I, you know, take a punt on a book that I don't know about, if it's from that collection, then I can be pretty sure that I'll like it.
Yeah, I think I collect all the ones you mentioned, Mary, except for Pensler, which I hadn't heard of. But and Fitzcarraldo, I only collect the nonfiction, not the fiction. I don't know why. And I wish their books were less, they get so grubby as soon as you read them.
That really does frustrate me about them, actually.
Yeah, they need to work on that, because the ones I've read are so tatty and horrible now. And I've recently bought up a whole bunch of Fairlight classics, I think that's what the series called, but Fairlight Books, who published 50 postcards that we did, sorry, blue postcards that we did recently, by Douglas Bruton. And I just loved the little format of Fairlight Moderns, they're called. I loved that little format and the interesting selection, and I went on the website and just read about all of them and bought a whole bunch of them. So I just read, I'm not gonna remember it, but I just read a really good one about someone with dementia. Okay, well, let's go on to the next question and I will look that up and put it in later. So I wrote about it early in May. Dev says, what was the last book you gave someone as a... Oh, no. Sorry, it's your turn to ask that question.
Dev says, what was the last book you gave someone as a gift and why did you choose it?
When did I last give someone a book as a gift? That's one I really should have prepared. I did give my friend Ellie the book about Gwen John, Letters to Gwen John by Celia Paul, Celia Paul is an artist, Gwen John also an artist, and they live a long time apart. They didn't know each other, but Celia John sort of addresses all things as though it were letters to this other artist. And that's her sort of frame for talking about her life and her art. And it's absolutely fascinating. And I know that my friend Ellie loves Gwen John, so I thought that was a nice book to give her.
Oh, that's nice. The last book I gave as a gift, They Came Like Swallows by William Maxwell to one of my beloved sick formers who's leaving. And I gave Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner to another one of my beloved sick formers who's leaving. And I like giving my students, when they leave, books that I love, that I think that they will love, that they wouldn't have come across otherwise. So hopefully
that's lovely.
And keep them. Yeah.
I've just found the book Only About Love by Debbie Voisey is the book about a guy with dementia, which is very good. Mm-hmm. Christopher says, I've just finished The Enchanted April. If you could go on holiday in a book complete with its characters, which would you go on?
Oh, no question. I'd go on the trip in Illyrian Spring with by Ambridge on the boat.
I was 100% sure you would say that.
So predictable. the beautiful Croatian coast. Why not?
Yeah, not to repeat myself, but I'm going on an expedition to the North Pole with Winnie the Pooh and his friends.
You mean you're so obsessed with Winnie the Pooh?
Yeah, turns out.
There we are. Right, am I pronouncing this Laura?
Yes.
Yes, Laura has asked, any advice on how you both manage during your PhD/masters for a healthy reading balance?
Well, this is something I was very keen on when I went back to do further study, because I had barely read a book for myself as an undergraduate. I was just constantly reading course books. Obviously, many of which I enjoyed, but I was determined if I was going to do any more study, I would also read for fun. So I just sort of prioritized it, really. And that's probably why my PhD took me 4 years rather than three. So took some sacrifice. But I was determined not to just give up on reading for pleasure for 3 or 4 years.
For me, I didn't. I've got two master's degrees. The first one I did part-time while I was also working full-time as a teacher. So there was no balance at that time because all of the only things that I read were for my master's because I didn't have time to do anything else because I was also working. My second one, I was working as well alongside it, but it was full-time, so I had a bit more time. And the balance for me with that was just being really strict with myself. So I had like certain days a week where I was like, no, I'm not reading anything for uni today. I'm going to read my book. And I always had a book that wasn't anything to do with university on the go. Otherwise, you do just get sucked into it and you don't have time for anything else.
So yeah, fair enough. I don't know if you're doing one, Laura, but good luck if you are. Brian says, what is your least favourite book by a writer you think of as a favourite?
That's sort of similar to what we've just talked
about. That's true, yeah.
Yeah, I would say probably, well, let me think of a different example then, because otherwise it's just a bit samey. I would say Jamaica Inn by Daphne du Maurier. Bit disappointed by that, really. I mean, after The Joy of Rebecca and The Brilliance of My Cousin Rachel, Jamaica Inn just felt really kind of like trashy in comparison, like lesser quality. Yeah.
It's one I've never read.
I don't think you'd enjoy it.
Which should I pick? Well, I love Agatha Christie. There's quite a lot that are not that great and many, many, many that are, but I think the worst book that I've read by her is Elephants Can Remember, which was very bad.
Okay, let me see. Dominica says, what are some of your favourite novels in translation?
Well, I really love anything T.F. Johansson wrote. I'm really enjoying the Soul Favela on the Calculation of Volume series. Those have quickly become favourites. And I've only ever read two books by Hungarian writers, but they were both very, very good. So I should read more Hungarian. So there's Embers by Sandor Marai and Skylark by someone whose name I could never possibly pronounce. So Deslo something maybe. So those are definitely all high up the list.
I really love Olga Tokarczuk's writing. She's Polish. Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead is my favourite, but I've also really enjoyed her most recent one, which is called The Impusium. And I mean, Fitzcarraldo editions are really good to find authors. I mean, Annie Ernaux, who's a French writer, her writing is fantastic. She kind of writes autobiographical fiction, and her book The Years was recently made into a play in Britain as well, which is fantastic. And I really recommend Vittorio Latronico's Perfection, which is
of course, yeah,
book translated from Italian. Really, really good.
We're going to split into two episodes because you've got so many questions. So that's the end of episode 150. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back with more of your questions in episode 151.